I'd like to start tonight. I have a presentation to make. Mary Lou, would you come up, please? I tell you, I saw a remarkable feat. For those of you who weren't here this morning, you have no idea what this woman endured standing right here. There was a group of home wreckers, building destroyers, construction of God knows, they sound like they were literally ripping the top of this building off amid crashes, and I never in my heart felt as much compassion for another speaker, because I know how hard it is to get up here. And God love her, she bravely went on, and I think she deserves something special. So I went and had this made. It says, grinder hammer, nor giant bump stop me. And I have a joke for our, is he the Echo, the Voice, or the whatever? What is he? The little weird guy in the orange jacket. I have a joke for you, one you won't have to explain. I remember Valentine, my name is Mary Pearl, they call me Murp, and I'm just one of those Valentines who's just happy, joyous, and free. I am glad to be here in Florida again. I've had some really pleasant memories. The last time I was here on the Gulf Coast, I was at the Gulf Coast Roundup when it was down in Panama City. And I didn't want to be here. I did not want to be here. I wanted to be in Hawaii that weekend. I had a big resentment. Those who were there at the conference remember that. I told them about it. You know, I'm one of these kind of persons. I do not suffer in silence. My husband prayed for that. I just couldn't do it. And I had been invited to go talk in Hawaii the same weekend that I had already committed to come down to the Gulf Coast that year. And then they later called me and said, we screwed up on the dates. And so that meant that I would have had that weekend open, and I really had some problem with that for a little while. My sponsor said, if you'd have been supposed to have been there, you'd have been there. Now shut up. Such a loving woman. But it was altogether different this time, because as you'll see as I go on later in my story, it's very important that I come and be with y'all this weekend, and I am very grateful. You know, it's a strange thing. You know, God has his ability to see around corners and at the end of things and what have you, and you don't know. You never know why you're where you are when you're supposed to be. I know my God takes care of me, and he puts me right where I'm supposed to be all the time, and I'm real grateful for that. Well, I'd like to thank the committee, and I'd like to thank Sarah, who's been my hostess. God knows she's had her work cut out. And she's done it with a stiff upper lip. You know how we Allen Arns are. We're up for the occasion. Doesn't make any difference what it is, man. We can do it. That's the reason I determined if that son of a was still out there hammering, I was going to knock you off the roof. Because now maybe the AAs don't know how to handle that kind of problem, but an Al-Anon can. I'm known as Mrs. Tactful in my group. If you believe that, you're going to love this story. No, I am here to share with you what I used to be like. What happened and what I'm trying to be like today. I like it when they say, I'm going to share with you what it used to be like. I've been calling it all my life. By God, I'm an I. I'm not an it, and I'm going to share with you what I used to be. And but I want to tell you about these little balloons last night. They got to worrying me, because every time the air conditioner come on, they'd start giving it this. And I turned to Kay and I said, you know what that looks like? Now, this is going to date me just a little bit, but anybody else see War of the Worlds? You know those little monsters that stuck their heads in those buildings and stuff? I said, they're bad, you know. Doesn't take much for some people. You know, I have a real active imagination. I want you to know right off that my drug of choice is adrenaline. I'm addicted to excitement, and if I don't have some, by God, I create some. And I don't really care what kind it is, because any of it gets your adrenaline moving. Now, I want to tell you about adrenaline, though. You can overdose. I didn't know it was possible. I really didn't. But I was out in California last year for the quake. Now, I want you to know, I live in Arkansas, which is Tornado Alley. Okay? And you know what to do in case of a tornado. You know, you get in a little bitty closed place, usually a closet, and you pray and you hang on to your butt and hope it ain't blown off. Now, that's what you do in a tornado. Now, an earthquake, it's a whole new set of rules. And I didn't even know to ask them. And I was by myself at this girl's house, and all of a sudden, you know how when the fire truck goes down the street, how that heavy motion feels? That's what I felt. And then after a few seconds, I thought, God, that is the longest fire truck I believe I've ever. And all of a sudden, then the doors on the cabinets begin to rattle. And the dishes begin to shake. And that's when, you know, I had that, you know, we're really keen on getting perception. Yeah. And I said, you know, not that I was scared or anything. And my next thing was, what do you do? What do you do? And I was just running in circles going, what do you do? What do you do? What do you do? Now, later, there was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous said, well, anybody knows it's in the front of the phone book. Well, if you can entertain when you're having a nervous breakdown, going to the phone book and having the presence of mind to read, much less follow instructions. And I realized later when it was all over, and it only took 26 seconds, which ruined another myth I had. See, I was under the idea that these people that are in these plane crashes and these earthquakes and stuff, it happens so quick, they don't know what's happening. They know. Trust me. They know. And that was a horrifying thought. But when it was all over, I didn't have anything on my body that was not tingling. And I sat down and I said, well, it's happened. I've overdosed with adrenaline. It's come to this. But that's the kind of excitement that I live in, you know. I mean, I'm always finding myself in those weird little situations. You know, it was bad enough two nights before when I was coming in. I was in an aborted flight. We got ready to land, and it's just like the one that crashed the other day. The pilot said, like that, and we just went all of a sudden, like, you know, like going from Cape Canaveral. We just went straight up. And I'm going, this doesn't seem right. We were down where I could count the cars now. And he said, excuse me, folks, we just had an abortion. And he said there was a little plane on our runway, so I'm sure it was at the LAX, same airport. Probably same darn controller over there. Must have a thing about dogs, everything else. I'd like to get stuff, but never mind. But like I say, I have a lot of funny experiences that happen to me, and it's real nice. It's real nice, because it keeps your adrenaline level pumping. I learned this early on as a child, and I did a lot of this by making my mother mad a lot. You know, I lived, like I say, I'm the youngest of four children, and my father was a retired military officer, and he spoiled me rotten. And I loved it. I love anybody that lets me have my way. That's the only requirement. You know, if y'all had just mind, I wouldn't even be here tonight. But I couldn't get people to mind. But anyway, Daddy would. And he would let me have anything, do anything I wanted to. He made my life wonderful. And I just worshipped him. And then there was the warden. And she wouldn't let me do nothing. If it even looked like fun, she said no. You know, it seemed to me she was put on earth to make my life miserable. And I hated her. I hated her right from the get-go. I just never could seem to connect with her. And I think, really, Daddy was sort of like a bone, and we were two dogs, and we fought over him. That's all I know. But the bottom line was he'd side against me against her, and I think he was sort of a passive-aggressive person when I look back on it. But the bottom line was I was spoiled rotten. And I was taught early on that if you throw a big enough fit, you can get what you want. You can see I was going to be in good training for alcoholism. Now, I knew what alcoholism was. From as far back as I can remember, I knew what alcoholism was because my mother's family were alcoholic. As far as I know, she didn't have anybody in her family that wasn't alcoholic in her immediate family. My mother's father died in our state hospital with wet brain from alcoholism. My mother's mother died from cirrhosis of the liver from alcoholism. My mother's oldest brother, my favorite, was killed in bed with another man's wife. He had an adrenaline problem, too. I remember one time we went fishing with him, and in the middle of the night we heard a gun go off, and I heard him scream, and I thought, my God, somebody shot him, and they had. He had. He saw something wiggling at the foot of his bed, and it was his toe, but he thought it was a snake and blew it plumb off. He was a fun person. You never knew what was going to happen with Uncle A.B. And then there was Uncle Ernie, and God love him. Uncle Ernie died has it been 2 years ago? Whatever, it's been the last year or two. And he and my mother's other sister used to have war on each other. And I love that. You know, that's kind of, this is what I watched in my mother's side of the family. I watched this war. They had a thing about doing to each other, you know. And each one of them tried a little one-upmanship. No matter what was going on, they sort of did it back and forth to each other, you know. And he'd do something to her, and then she'd get even. And then he'd do something to get even with her getting even. And it got pretty serious long toward the end. You got to remember now, they're in their 80s. And so they lived next door to one another, which wasn't good either. And she did something that really bothered him, and he did something that bothered her, and they did that, and then he got revenge, and he set her house on fire and burned her room off. Well, now, this made her real mad, so she had him committed for being a nut, and I felt like they'd take her, too, if they ever got out there and saw that. But they didn't, and bless his heart, he died. But I got even for him, because it just didn't seem right to let it sit there. Now, many years ago, one of her husbands died, and they put him out there, and she had a great big monument made to go on his tomb. And she had his name born, died, her name born, and left a blank. Well, every time she'd go out there drunk up and look at that stone, that'd bug her, because that's her tombstone, you know. So she had him take it off the grave. So he only had this little plastic card for a long time. And then finally, she got where she could put it back on. So when I went out there, when we buried Uncle Ernie, I beat everybody out to the cemetery and I filled in her date. Give her something to think about. I felt like Uncle Ernie would have loved it myself. I learned slow, premeditated revenge was great. You know, that's what I learned. And I saw all these things, you know. And it never occurred to me, and I'm sure it didn't you either when you were growing up, how much stuff that you were taking and putting inside of you, how much wrong information. You'd get some information, but what you perceived was not what was really there. And I don't know about you, but I found out when I did a fourth and fifth step that I was still operating as an adult with the same ideas that I had adopted as a child. And many of them hadn't worked, had never worked, and I was still giving them a good old try. Just couldn't give up. You know, and I've learned in here there's a spiritual axiom that says if you do what you've always done, you get what you've always got. And somehow or another, for a brilliant person like myself, it's funny that I had to come to a bunch of idiots to tell me that. You know, I just couldn't understand that. But anyway, I was an overachiever, always was. And I was just tooling along there in my life, like say, and then my daddy died when I was 12 years old. And that was a terrible thing for her. That was the worst thing daddy ever did, was leave me with her. Because we had no relationship, none whatsoever. And I blamed her for being alive. I wanted my daddy, and I began to take my daddy and make him a saint. Now, I didn't know I was doing that. And I compared everything she did against what I thought my daddy would have done, and she always came up on the short end of the stick. And how I perceived things were not necessarily how they were, but it's how I perceived them, and that's how I reacted to them, and they were real to me. And so I declared war on her. And the war was, whoever dies, the other one wins. And so I set out to do everything humanly possible to make my mother's life miserable. And I did it. I gave her nightmares. From just little bitty things to great big things. Anything I could do. Basically, I did everything she told me not to do at least twice. And this was not the way to do it. But I was a rebellious child. And you see, I've always had that I know what I'm going to do and that self-will, and I'm going to do what I want to do. And if you don't like it, tough. That was my thing. Well, after I got out of high school, I'd had several boyfriends and what have you, but it got especially bad at our house, and I began to become dedicated to getting out away from home. I didn't want to live there with her anymore. And about that time, 1957 it was, I graduated in 60, but in 1957, Mecca arrived in Little Rock. Little Rock Air Force Base. There was 10 men for every woman. And I wanted my 10. And your 10. And anybody else's 10. I thought it was wonderful. And they had all the people that were there, and they had all, some of them had some of the funniest accents. And I met this one boy one night at the bowling alley. Should have known right off I shouldn't have had him. He was so dumb. He had set a Coke on the slanted surface like that and expected it to stay, and it fell all over my clothes. And I, it's one way to meet somebody, but I wasn't really impressed with him. But later on, when he told me how beautiful I was and everything, I began to get more impressed with him. And next thing I know, after a few months, he asked me if I would marry him. And I thought, why not? I said, if you promise to take me away from here. I said, I hate this place. I've been living to get away from here. And he said, I will. I'm in the Air Force. He said, where would you like to go? And I said, oh, I'd like to go to France or Germany or England or, you know, someplace real neat. And he said, well, I'll put in for it. And he did. And we went to Newfoundland. I didn't even know where it was. I had to get the map down. It was not a place you want to go. You know, it was considered to me the last outpost of humanity. Now, I have a friend in Winnipeg, and he says it's not, but you can see it from there. You know, I mean, we're talking a remote assignment here. And it was, to show you how well I was, we extended and stayed there 5 years. But I got, you know, I'm an adapter. Wherever you put me, I can adapt. I can adapt. I can do it, you know, because I have that attitude. Ain't nothing going to beat me. And so when I got there, I nearly lost it, though, there, because I had to, it was boring. Now, see, boredom's a character defect. I didn't know that. But you see, that's because I have this need for excitement. And so when I get bored, hang on. Well, it was around Christmas time, and I was getting bored. See, you couldn't do anything in Newfoundland. I mean, we're talking 290 inches of snow the first year I was there. Now, when you get out in snow and it's up to your butt, you know, there's just not a lot you can do, you know. But I got to reading, because I, you know, being housebound so much, I read a lot. And, oh, I love to read. Always did love to read. Had a thirst for knowledge. Not that I could do anything with it, but I had a thirst for it. And so I got to thinking about this. And see, that's another thing that's dangerous for me, is thinking. Because I have, sort of like my friend Clancy says, I have a whole committee. I have discussions in my head. We have arguments in my head. It's just like 10 or 12 people are going on up there all at the same time, you know. And we reach a group conscience every once in a while. And we do things. And then sometimes I find myself doing things that bypass the committee. I don't know what happened. I can't explain it to you. But anyway, I've been reading about, you know, what a traditional Christmas is all about. Well, then I see down here, y'all don't have a lot of Christmas trees growing either. Well, we don't in North Little Rock either. But I was in the land of Christmas trees. They don't have trees with leaves on them. So, all these little green needles. So I thought to myself, well, now we'll go up this hill, which was actually a mountain. And I said, we will cut down a Christmas tree and bring it back home and decorate it with these little popcorn chains. And it'll be so sweet, and just like in the book, just like in the book. However, things never quite turn out like I planned them to do. I asked the two boys who lived next door to me. That was a bad move, because that was my landlady's sons. And they had a toboggan. Now, I don't know how many of y'all are familiar with a toboggan. Now, if there's people from the north, they know. It's a flat board with a curl on the end of it. That's it. But it's a long thing. And I said, but what we could do is we could cut down the tree, put it on the toboggan, and drag it home. Sounded good. And I got my husband and the two boys, and here we went. Now, I've got to explain how we are physically located here. We live in this apartment complex at the bottom of the hill. We had steps cut in the ice. There was about 18 or 20 of them up to the road. And on the other side of the road was this mountain. So we went all the way up the mountain, and we're cutting down trees. Now, the reason we cut down trees was that there's something that happens when you cut them down and they fall over. They don't look as good as they did when they were standing up. And you know it's got to be perfect. You can't have a tree that's not perfect. So you'd cut down another tree and another tree, and pretty soon I had enough for everybody in the apartment complex who had not asked me to bring them a tree. But I'm always doing for others. So I told them, I said, now we had this rope. I said, we're going to tie all these trees on this toboggan, and we're going to take them back down the hill. Now, it would have been okay, but you see, I never can leave anything alone. I improve upon the plan as I go. They call me Captain Spontaneity. You know, I mean, I get in there and I go for it. And that's when the idea hit me, why don't we ride down on top of the trees? This could be exciting. And there was a piece of rope left over, and I thought, well, I'll tie me on because I don't want to fall off. Now I get on this toboggan. Now I know not the first thing about a toboggan, but I'm going to gain some information real quick. But it ain't going to do me a darn bit of good. And that is, going downhill, you gain lots of speed. There are no brakes on a toboggan. There's no steering mechanism on a toboggan. You're just going down. Well, as we began to go down and we began to go faster, we went over some smaller trees. Well, they got thrown off. But not me, see, because I'm tied on. So all of a sudden, I'm coming down that hill, lickety-split, and there's a road there, you know. And there's cars going back and forth on the road. And I shot between the cars. And I went down those ice steps and through the bottom of my house. Well, it splintered me and the toboggan and the trees. And my landlady ran outside because, see, she was in the middle apartment. And she didn't know if the bomb had dropped, the sonic boom, or what. I mean, you can imagine that was quite an impact as I went through the bottom of the house. And she said, what are you after doing, you crazy Yankee bitch? And I looked up at her and I said, don't you call me no damn Yankee. That's a typical day in my life. Well, I created enough excitement over the next 5 years that it cost me my marriage. I was doing better off on the toboggan, but nonetheless, I decided. I worked for the Red Cross overseas, and that's a wonderful power position because no one leaves the base on an emergency leave coming back home without Red Cross verification. That's just the way the military works. And so I loved it, you know. And it's a pretty good bargaining tool. And not only that, I was living in the land of liquor. Now, here we had a liquor. Cigarettes back then was 90 cents a carton. Can you believe that? And you could buy a gallon of Chevy's for $5. I mean, it was just wonderful. And I loved to go to the clubs, and I loved to party, and I loved everything about it. I loved the tinkling sound of the glasses. I loved the horrible music. I loved the slot machines. I loved the guys. I just had a wonderful time up there. And it was also shredded around alcohol. And see, my mother had said to me, don't you ever drink alcohol, because you know I carry the bad seed. Well, I knew she had something. But I wanted to do those things, and I enjoyed drinking, and I had a lot of fun over there in those bars and what have you. And looking back on that, I can see now there were a lot of people who probably had drinking problems that were in our crowd of friends. I can see that today. But you see, all I knew about alcoholism was my mother's family and the way they drank. And what they did, they would drink a lot of whiskey, and then they would fight with one another, and they'd get revenge on one another. And if I saw people not doing that, to me, they didn't have a drinking problem. And who doesn't get drunk once in a while, you know? I mean, hell, I've been drunk 3 times. You know, it wasn't a big deal. My hat's off to alcoholics. I don't know how you stand that mess. I have never learned how to do projectile puking, you know. I don't know how to do that, you know. I just choke on it and all like that. I can't stand here and puke that. I just can't. But anyway, I told my husband, I said, I'm going to call this guy down in Sacasimons and find out where we're going. And I found out we were going to Minot, North Dakota. Now, I did not want to go to Minot, North Dakota. You know where I wanted to go? I wanted to go back to Little Rock, that place I couldn't stand to get away from. See, I knew everything was going to be different over there now. I just knew everything was going to be okay back in Little Rock. Because I was tired of that, and I wanted to go back to something familiar. What I wanted to do was, I wanted to get rid of him, but I wanted to do it on ground I was familiar in. I didn't know that at the time, but that was what the underlying deal was there. And so I called the assignment section, and I told the guy, I said, I want to go to Little Rock. He said, there's not an opening at Little Rock. I said, make one. I said, what are you doing over there with your typewriter? Do something. He said, well, it'll cost you. I said, what'll cost me? He said, a case of Chevys. I said, on the next plane down to Westover. And so just like that, Wes was sent back to Little Rock Air Force Base. There was just one little problem. There wasn't an opening in his career field. He was an aircraft mechanic. Overnight, he became a missile inspector. And he had never seen one. Doesn't that make you feel secure? So anyway, there we were. And after a while, I convinced him that what we needed to do was separate. And the reason I say separate is I was not ready to become self-supporting through my own voluntary contributions. I wanted to be free of him, but with the money. So I can, you know how we are masters of fast talking for slow thinking. So I got him convinced that what he should do was set me up an allotment where I didn't have to do anything if I didn't choose to. And then he could go on and go wherever base he wanted to, do whatever he wanted to do, and I was going to be there for a while. And I needed to find myself. Don't you remember those terms back in the 60s? Let's find ourselves. Isn't it funny where we look? Well, I tell you what I found when I was looking, and I found alcoholics. Now, by the grace of God, I do not have the allergy to alcohol. As far as I can see, that's the only thing that's different between me and an alcoholic. But I do have the ability to be a carrier, because everybody I seem to come in contact with was one. You know, they're just everywhere. They're everywhere. The guy across the street from me was one. The guy that lived next door to me was one. They were everywhere. And they drove me crazy. They drove me crazy. The boy across the street, every time he'd go out and get drunk, he'd come in and whip his wife. That's a terrible thing. I can't stand to see a man abuse a woman. Women can abuse men. That's okay. I believe in a double standard. And it would just irritate me, and this girl was pregnant, and he'd come in and whip her. And one night he came in, and she was, the night she went into labor, and he whipped her. And she came over, and she had a black eye, and her nose was bleeding. And she said, would you take me to the hospital? She said, I'm going to have my baby. And I said, okay. And we went back over to her house to get her things. And you know how a drunk will pass out with that little smirk like they can do, you know? He's laying there on the bed with that smirk on his face, and I thought, you know, somebody ought to whip you. And that's when I had my first spiritual awakening. I'm somebody. So I tied him up in his bed sheet. I took a slat out of his bed, and I beat the fool out of him. Enjoyed every minute of it. Okay, now the guy lived on the other side of me. He went to the doctor. The doctor told him he was an alcoholic and he better quit drinking or he'd die. I don't know if he told him to go to Alcoholics Anonymous or not. He never did. And the bottom line was he did die, but he died irritable, restless, and discontent. He was one miserable person. Now, because I don't work and I like to do, I've always been a night person. And so I would go to bed around 7 in the morning, and this guy had the audacity to run a garden tiller at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I explained to him that I was trying to sleep. And he told me to shut my mouth and get my fat ass back in the house. He shouldn't have done that. I went down to my mama's garage and I got my daddy's frog-gigging headlight out. And I mowed my grass at 11:30 at night. Well, the sheriff came to see me. And I don't know about you, but my experience with law is that they are pretty narrow-minded. So now, but I want to let you know that any Al-Anon worth of salt has contingency plans. And so I went into Plan B. Now, Plan B was a little different. See, this guy had 6 beagle dogs. And if you've ever had one beagle, you know you got a barking little dog. One of them little yap-yaps, you know. And so I would go in the middle of the night, in the wee hours of the morning, I would go at up and down his dog yard fence with a broom handle. And then I'd run back on my porch. Well, he'd come out, scream at him, cuss at him, hose him off. And then he'd go back in the house. He'd wait about an hour, and we'd do it one more time. Well, the sheriff came to see me. Well, there were 3 or 4 more instances, and the sheriff and I were developing a relationship. So I decided I better cool that. So I had to do something else. Besides, that gets boring after a while. You know, doing the same thing. So I need some more excitement. And that's when I noticed we had a neighborhood softball team. My God, where had I been that I hadn't noticed? Because here's all these wonderful men out there on that team, and only one or two women. God, it was Mecca again. And I said, I'm going to join the team. So I got me some hot pants and stretch boots, and I went down to join the team. Well, it was wonderful, because after the game, we'd go over to somebody's house, and we'd pop a few tops, and some of them would smoke a little grass, and some of them would drop a little acid, you know, just having fun. And I always had to be around people like that. Because, you see, I had to find somebody who I felt like I could look at and say, at least I'm not that bad. I had to find that in order to feel good about me. See, that should have told me something about me, but it didn't tell me anything then. And so one night they were all over at my house, and there was a boy there on our team who was 18 years of age, and that was not old enough to drink in the state of Arkansas. And so he had bought a China tea set for his mother for Mother's Day, and he was carrying that in his truck, and he had brought that in and showed it to us and said, what do you think? And all of a sudden, you know, when he got so drunk, I could just see him being picked up by the law going home, and the law would say, at the sheriff, would say, where'd you get it? And he'd say, I got it out at Mary's. And I'd say, oh, my God. And then I'd be in trouble with the law again. And I just didn't want that. So I said, I'll tell you what. Somebody follow me, and I'll drive him home and take this China tea set in before he breaks it, because you know how good we are about helping people. And I said, that'll take care of it. So now I get the picture. It's 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm going in a strange house with a drunken 18-year-old kid, and I'm carrying a China tea set. Your everyday experience. And he flips the light on in the bedroom. There's a man laying there, nothing on but his shorts. And he looks up and says, well, hot damn, little brother, you brought us a broad home. I said, not tonight, fella. And that's who I'm married to today. I always love them little sweet stories, how they meet, you know. Can't relate at all. But anyway, a few months later, we met a little more orthodox than that, and then we started dating, because we both loved to wallow in self-pity. And he would tell me what a rotten marriage he had had, and I told him what a rotten marriage I'd had, and then we developed this wonderful relationship for the next 2 years. And then he ruined it all. He asked me to marry him. And that's when, you know, this wonderful, honest, open, share-anything-with-each-other relationship was going to have a little bit of a nick in it here. Because, you see, I'd forgotten to mention I was married. And I told him, I said, I can't marry you because I'm still married. And he said, you sure didn't act married. I said, well, I didn't feel married either. I said, I just forgot. I said, for God's sake, don't you ever forget anything? He said, not like that. So anyway, I got a divorce, and then J.D. and I got married. Now, little did I know that J.D. was a full-blown alcoholic when we married. You see, I knew that when he drank too much, and I saw his personality change. But you see, he wouldn't have to do that once we got married, because his mama told me, she said, Mary, all he needs is the love of a good woman. That'll kill people. Did you know it? That'll kill them, you know? I hated that old heifer for a long time, you know? So the problem, see, he was living at home with her. That's the reason she was promoting that deal. And the problem came over to my house. And, you know, it wasn't that much of a problem at first, like a lot of things. It just sort of grows on you. You know, the progression of the disease of alcoholism for a while is sort of slow, and then it begins to roll. And once it gets to rolling, then it's on. But, you know, Al-Anonism is the same way. Because my disease that I'd had all my life, you see, I was a prize now, can't you? You know, I'm so good. I love it when people get up and say, I was okay except for that alcoholic coming in my life. Well, I wasn't. You know, I just don't believe that. I look at people and they come in and they'll say, well, you know, I just don't understand. I think there's something wrong with you, or he wouldn't have been attracted to you in the first place. You know, that kind of deal. I think sick attracts sick. Because it tells us it's a child-to-child calling. And I was the responsible one. And I was the one that needed somebody to need him. And he wanted somebody to take care of him. And you know, there's an old saying, what goes round comes round. Now see, I wanted my husband, my first husband, to take care of me, and I didn't want to do anything. And that was okay. Well, J.D. wanted to marry me and him not do anything. And that wasn't okay. But that was what goes around comes around. And so here I found myself a few years later taking care of him. And I was working, and I was working a lot of overtime, and I was trying to do because he just wouldn't work. He just couldn't work because his drinking got in the way. And a lot of strange things began to happen at our house. I don't know about you, but we had bizarre incidents. And I know today the reason we had bizarre incidents is because I would put myself in positions not a normal human being in this world ever would. I would put myself into bizarre circumstances. You know, like for instance, the alcoholics go to jail. I mean, y'all are supposed to go to jail. We're not. Well, I've been to jail. And it didn't start out that way. I was trying to save my home. I would be driving and I'd see my car parked at one of those kind of places. One of them really seedy. You know, he got to where he would go to the seediest beer joints so I wouldn't follow him. I would do what was necessary to do. It hurt me that he would have me go in such places. I took our little dog and I took it in and set it down on the bar in front of him and I said, "Come home, we're hungry." He couldn't go there anymore, so that embarrassed him to death. I would go in and find him, and he always had a friend. She. You know, those lower companions. When I was one, it was okay. Now it is not okay. And I looked at him over there, and I said, "Well, I'll put an end to this mess." And I'd stroll across that bar, and I'd turn that table upside down, slap her flat, throw a drink in his face, and proceed to pulverize him. And the bouncer throw me out. And if I got a little too frisky with the bouncer, then I'd go to jail for assault. It was just wasn't fair. Was not fair. Finally got to the point where, you know, you've had all this excitement you can stand. And I told him, I said, "You're either going to quit drinking or you're going to leave." Now, many times I threw his clothes out in the front yard and then have to run back and get them before daylight so the neighbor wouldn't see. But this time I meant it. And he knew I meant it. You know, there comes a point in time when you just can't stand. You know, it's like the disease is progressive. Well, it was for me too. There was a time when I went looking for him and then that ended. There was a time when I would wait up and then when he'd walk through the door, my mouth seemed to be attached to it. And I would yell, "Have you been drinking?" Now, I don't know why we ask that question. They can't stand up. They smell like God knows what. "Have you been drinking?" And of course he'd say, "No." Or, "Two." I don't know why AA bothers to print all that damn literature with questions. You know, like 20 questions. Ask one question. When you drink, how many do you drink? And if they say more than two, they are not alcoholic. If it's two, they are alcoholic. And then, because he had lied to me, I'd say, "You're a drunk and a liar." And he'd say, "So what?" And I'd say, "So this." And I'd put him out of my misery. Now, I'm not proud of that. I'll tell you what, when you abuse people, when you abuse them physically or emotionally, it does something really bad to you on the inside. And you know, I'd get right up in his face and I'd say, "Come on and hit me. If you're a man, hit me." And he wouldn't. He just wouldn't. And I'd say, "You are a wimp." And he'd say, "I can't hit a woman." I don't know if he'd say that today. But anyway. So what we were doing, without me knowing it, we were playing a little game. I was mama and he was the bad little boy. I told him not to drink. He went out and got drunk. Took his whipping and then it was all over. Just like when he was a kid at home. And he didn't have to feel any guilt. He didn't have to feel any remorse because, you see, I relieved that of him. One day at a time, I relieved him because I played those games with him. So it was different this time, though. I told him, I said, "I'm not going to put up with this anymore." And he said, "Okay." He said, "I don't know why I do what I do." He said, "I guess I'm sick." And I said, "That's the truth. You are sick, sick, sick." So I took him to our family physician who told him to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And J.D. said he was not an alcoholic. I said, "That's right, he's not. Because he didn't drink like my mother's people. I could not accept that he was an alcoholic." So now we're going to enter the real fun year. This is the year where he's not drinking. Because, you see, he had several friends that were taking antabuse, and he said, if I just had a little help. He said, if I just had a little help. So the doctor, he told the doctor that his friends were taking antabuse. He wanted to take antabuse. And so the doctor said, okay. And he gave him a prescription, which I took away from him. And I went and got it filled, because, see, I didn't trust him. And what I heard the doctor say was, here's a pill, he can't drink. That's not what the doctor said, but that's what I heard, because, you know, you hear what you want to hear, you see what you want to see. And so I became the keeper of the pill. Now, by this time, I have high blood pressure, an epileptic dog, and J.D.'s on the pill. In a hurry, getting dressed in the mornings, I can't guarantee you who took what, but everybody got a pill. Well, I begin to see what the big book talks about when it says irritable, restless, and discontent. Because I was living with a man who was not drinking, who was worse than the man who was drinking. And I couldn't understand that because, you see, all this time I had thought, if he'll quit drinking, I'll be okay. That's like, I've got a headache. If you take an aspirin, I'll be okay. I didn't realize what I was saying all that time. But that's what I was doing. And so he wasn't drinking and he was miserable because he had no treatment for his alcoholism. On the other hand, I had no treatment for my Al-Anonism either. And so we began this delicious hatred, and where I took up where I had left off with Mother, and we declared war, and here we went again. And see, that's the thing we'll do. If we don't find something different, we'll go back to a known entity. We'll play that old tape and we'll go back again. And so that's what I did. And it really became horrible to live in our house. We had a cuss fight every day. We hated each other. We did a lot of mean, cruel, hateful things to each other because we were very sick people, and we were blaming. He was blaming me, and I was blaming him. And let me tell you, when you're blaming somebody, there is no hope whatsoever for you because we are powerless over other people. But if what you are doing contributes to your misery, you can change that, so there is hope. So, and I hear a lot of people nowadays say, I'm this way because that's the way I chose to be. And it was choices that I made not knowing any other way to do it at the time. And many times with me, knowing what I was doing wasn't working, but not having the idea what to do else than what I was doing. And it was I had to come here to find out how to quit doing the sick and learn how to do the well things. But anyway, so the bottom line, I decided that, you know, I needed him out of my life. It was him. Now, I didn't want to get another divorce. Because if you get one divorce, you're allowed that. You're allowed to make a mistake. But if you have to get another divorce, that means that there's something wrong with your picker. And you're picking the wrong people here. And my ego would not let me do that. And so it occurred to me one day, if I were a widow, that's an honorable state. But he wasn't dying fast enough. And so I decided there had to be a way to get rid of him, and I began to think about it, and my favorite was taking an ice pick, stabbing him in the neck, and watching him drip. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And then I had the one where I would dream about backing over him with the car and watching his flesh ooze up in the tread. Always kept good tires on the car. Wanted good tread marks. I began to think about this, and I thought, there's not a court in the world that'll find me guilty of anything. It's justifiable homicide. My God, if you were living in the hell I was living in, you'd do the same thing. And then a woman killed her husband for pretty much the same thing, and they put her away. And I said, that's just tacky, tacky, tacky. If I'd have been on that jury, I would have, yay! You know, I couldn't understand, so I knew then I had to come up with the perfect crime. And then one night it occurred to me that if a drunk were to pass out in the bathtub and drown, who would know? I still think that would work. But anyway, if I think on something long enough, I know this about me. I will act upon it, be it positive or negative. It doesn't make any difference. If I think on it long enough, I will play it out. And I didn't know that about me. And you see, a year to the week that J.D. went on the antabuse, J.D. got drunk. How can that be? I thought those antabuse were like Alka-Seltzers. You just put them in, they went, and they were gone. And he was putting them under his tongue and then spitting them out. That was a sneaky thing to do. But anyway, he came in drunk, and when he did, I saw red. And I looked out, and it was snow on the ground, and he had wiped out our hitching post horse at the end of the driveway. He had hit a tree and bounced into the side of the house. And I thought, God, he can't drive on this stuff. And then he poured out of the truck. Well, I'd seen it too many times. And I said, I'll kill the SOB if it's the last thing I ever do. And so what I did was, when he came in the door, I didn't say anything. I just hit him as hard as I could. And when I did, he fell and he hit the coffee table and knocked him out. And I drug him across the living room floor, down the hall, into the bathroom. I ran the bathtub full of warm water. I took his clothes off. I put him in and I held him under till the bubbles quit coming, because I hated him. And then there was a voice inside my head that said, you can't do this. Look what you're doing. You can't do this. And I picked him up by the hair of the head and I said, the hell I can't. And I put him back down again. And the voice came back and it said, you're committing murder. You're taking the life of someone you once loved. And it liked to have scared me to death. Talks about it in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, where it says there's a moment of clarity in which you see yourself as you have really become. And I realized I had become an animal to treat an illness. And so I snatched him out of that tub. Thank God I had worked for the Red Cross and knew how to resuscitate. And I resuscitated him, and I put him in the bed. I dried his hair. I didn't want him to catch cold. Step two's there for a reason. Trust me. And I shut the door on the room and I left. And I went into the other part of the house and I heard him scream and I heard him holler for help. But for the next 3 days, I would not go in that room, and J.D. did not come out of that room. And J.D. liked to have died in that room of alcoholic poisoning. He had drank too much in a short period of time. His body had lost the ability to pass out and he had overloaded with alcohol. He liked to have hemorrhaged to death in there. And I would have been just as guilty of murder for that as I would have been for what I had done. But you see, I didn't know anything about alcoholism. All I know was that one afternoon I came in from work and he was sitting at our bar and he was shaking really bad. And he said, I must be an alcoholic. Could you call Alcoholics Anonymous for me? And I said, why don't you call him yourself? He said, I've tried. I can't dial the phone. I'm shaking so hard. So I keep getting the wrong number. So I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and they told me there was a meeting in 1 hour's time, 6 blocks away from our house. So I took J.D. over to that meeting, and it was held in a building that was built by a man who died in a state hospital from wet brain. My grandfather built the building where AA meets. And so J.D. has, from that point to today, has not found it necessary to take a drink. He got into recovery that night in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am very grateful. Now, I was pissed off at the time because, you see, what could a group of drunks do for him that I hadn't done? I could not understand why being with a bunch of seedy people was going to help anybody. So when I took him over that night, I was dressed appropriately because I didn't want to offend you people. So I got something that looked like from the Salvation Army grab bag. And I had on this old leopard skin coat and I had a red hat on pulled way down with checkerboard sunglasses. And they thought I was the drunk and he was the Al-Anon. But you know, that didn't get me into Al-Anon. There were two women there that night and they said, we have Al-Anon, it's for you. And I said, there's nothing wrong with me, thank you very much. I mean, I just tried to commit murder a week ago. That's no big deal. You see, if he hadn't got drunk, I wouldn't have had to do that. I justified and rationalized everything I did, so it made it okay. That's how you live with what you do. You justify and rationalize rotten behavior so that you can live with it. And deep down inside, you know it's not right, and you know you're lying to yourself. But after a while, you get to where you can stand that, and then you go on. But there comes a point in time when you get where you cannot swallow it anymore. And that was going to happen to me after I got into Al-Anon. But anyway, I started coming to Al-Anon later. And when I got in Al-Anon, they told me, you know, I get real tickled at the alcoholics that gripe about going to 90 meetings in 90 days. I always have considered it a privilege to be able to go to a meeting. Because, my God, there was lots of, think of the nights that you stayed home and that you paced the floor and that you were absolutely out of your mind. Wouldn't you have given anything to be able to go somewhere to be with people who would love you, who would understand you? And then they bitch about going. You know, it's like, I just hate having to go over there and get well. You know, I love it when people come in and they say, how long do I have to be here before I get a sponsor and have to work the steps? I say, I don't know, how long you want to die? It's all right with me. But anyway, I went over there, and there were these two women that were there, and I told them, they had two other guests from another group that night, and I said, ladies, I'm here for two purposes. A, how do you keep an alcoholic sober? And B, how do you manage when there's nothing left to manage? Because you see, when J.D. got sober, everything went to hell in a handbasket. He lost his job. Everything in the world was happening. The car quit. I mean, anything that could go wrong seemed to be going wrong. And I thought sobriety was supposed to be the panacea, that this was the destination. I didn't know it was the beginning. And I heard an AA speaker. I had been in the program about 2 weeks, and I heard an AA speaker from Washington, and he said that a lot of times you come into the program and things get worse, but you can get better. And God, I hung on to that. I had that, and I kept telling myself, things may get worse, and they sure did, but I could get better. And I got me a sponsor. I cannot stress to you the importance of a sponsor. All my life, I knew how to do everything. Don't tell me anything. I can handle it all by myself. Thank you very much. And it really irritated me to have to get someone to tell me how to do stuff. But you see, your best thinking got you here. So anything's bound to be up from that. So I got this woman, and I would call her, and not that I needed to, but that I would call her, and she would do really irritating things. She would tell me there was words I couldn't use in my vocabulary. And I thought, huh? And she said, it's yes, but, what if, and I know. She said, if you say yes, but, you're killing yourself with uniqueness. Yes, but don't you see my case is different? She said, people die from being different. They don't die from being the same. And I'd say, I know. And she'd say, yeah, I know you know. And as long as you think you know, you'll never learn. She said, when you learn that you don't know, because see, when you'd ask me something, if I didn't know the answer, I'd fake it and tell you something. I couldn't tell you I didn't know. And then I'd say, but what if? And she'd say, that hadn't happened. You're living in something that's not real. What if is a fantasy world. She said, get out of that. And she said, I'm not going to listen to those six words. And I said, well, what if I say one? And she hung up. Because I said, what if, see? And, you know, I had to have little lessons like that to teach me what I could do and what I couldn't do. And little by little, I began to learn a little bit. It's taken a long time. And, you know, after I'd been in the program about 5 years, God, I got so smart. I got so wonderful. You know, I got just sort of Miss Allen on-ish, you know. And I knew everything there was to know. I could even recite how it works. You know, I was really good. I went to all the open AA meetings, just loved the alcoholics. And I had a major slip. And guess what? I couldn't call anybody because, see, I knew everything. My pride wouldn't let me call for help. You know, there's old-timers out there, friends, that are dying from that very same thing. I'm glad it happened to me early on, because it would kill me today. It would kill me. And, you know, I love people that say, well, I don't have to go to as many meetings as I once did. My meetings are more important to me today than they were the first year I came in, because I have the ability to grasp something now and use it instead of just sitting in there. You know, I love it, just going to meetings, sitting in the meetings. It's like sitting in the garage hoping you're going to be a car. It's working the steps that makes you different, not sitting in the damn meeting. But you need to go there to be with the people so that you can hear. And they'll have to tell you at least 300 times before you'll even grasp the concept. You know? And then one night you'll say, guess what I heard tonight? And they'll go, well, thank God. We've been telling you for 4 years. It makes you feel real stupid, you know? But it doesn't matter, because once you hear it and once you name it and claim it, it's yours then. It's yours. And there were so many things I was going to have to learn, and there were so many areas in my life. I said, well, what do I have to change? They said, well, in your case, everything. And that's scary, but you know, that's been true. I've had to change everything in my life, and I have fought it. And we were talking this morning about letting go of things. You know, we're taught in here we're to let go and let God, and they said, letting go is so hard. I said, no, letting go is easy. Hanging on will kill your ass. You think about it. Anybody here water ski? I said, when you water ski, and you know, the first basic concept is when you fall, let go of the rope. And if you don't let go, you'll drink the lake. It's just that simple. So it's not letting go that hurts you. It's hanging on. So whenever I'm feeling that pain, I thank God I'm drinking the lake. What am I doing here? You know, that's a choice. And I don't know why we think that we've got to hang on to something, because the more I hang on to things, the more I have a tendency to squeeze the life out of them. I have a tendency just to just tear them to pieces when I hang on. And what causes that is that fear. When I'm so afraid that I'm going to lose something, I can guarantee you that you're never going to lose anything that God can't replace with something better. You will never do. God never just leaves you out there dangling. Sometimes you feel like you're dangling. You know, like the guy on the side with the, holding on the thing. He said, if there be a God up there, you know, say something. And God says, let go of the branch. And he says, anybody else up there? You know, you feel like that at times. You feel like that. But it doesn't always happen. Well, I want you to know that J.D. and I have been married over 21 years. We've been married now twice as long in sobriety as we were in the sickness and the active alcoholism. And we have a marriage today, and we have a good relationship. And it's not just because we both sit there. We both had to make, after a point in time, I mean, your personal recovery has to come first. And after a point in time, then we got well enough to be able to work on a relationship. It was very difficult to try to work on a relationship when you didn't have any idea who in the hell you were. You've got to know who you are and what you are and what's wrong with you and start about fixing that before you can do anything about having a healthy relationship. And we didn't know that for a long time. But today we know that, and we love and appreciate one another, and we have bad days like everybody else. You know, people come in the program, they say, well, you're in the program now, it's all going to be uphill from here, and that's a crock, because it has been my experience. Worst things in the world have happened since we've been in the program. The hardest things that we've ever had to go through have been since we've been in the program. J.D.'s had cancer since we've been in the program. And by the grace of God, he's healed and he's okay. There have been many things. I want to share with you tonight just one of these things, one of the biggest miracles of my life. And that is the relationship with my mother. This was the sickest relationship, even more sick than that with the alcoholic, was the one with my mother. Because I had had it for so long. And when the student's ready, the teacher will appear. And there was a girl that came down from Missouri for a year, and she had had mother problems. And she began to share with me what she had done, and she began to point out to me some of my shortcomings. And she said, the first thing I noticed is that you don't accept your mother's limitations any more than she accepts yours. I said, what does that mean? And I said, all I ever wanted from my mother was for her to love me. And that's the one thing she did not do, was love me. She never gave me approval. She never, anytime I did anything, it was never quite good enough. It was never right. I bring home straight A's. That was what was considered acceptable. Anything less than straight A's was bad. That was considered the norm. So you got no praise for straight A's. I could get all this stuff from other people, but I couldn't get it from her. And it seemed like to me there was a gnawing inside of me that nothing could get rid of. I had to have it from her, and I couldn't get it. So I always ended up going over there. We'd get into an argument. I'd be frustrated. I would leave with my feelings hurt, or I would say something really hateful to her and feel real good about it for 2 seconds and then hate my own guts as I drive away and say, my God, I've done it one more time. And I was doing this years in Al-Anon. And then Betty told me, she said, just try to accept your mother as she is. She said, acceptance of another person just as they are is the greatest form of love that you can give another person. And I'd say, our favorite expression, but it's not fair. It's just not fair. She said, that's right, it's not, and that's how it is. Now what? So I said, well, I'll think about that. And on the way home from a meeting one night, I started crying, and I said, God, you've been my daddy for a long time now. I'm going to ask you to be my mama too, because I'm tired of hurting. I'm tired of hurting over my mama, and so I'm going to give it up. I'm going to give up my dream, because see, that's what I had. In my mind, I had a dream, sort of like a June Cleaver type person that I wanted my mother to be, and she wasn't. And I had to give up that idea, because as long as you have an idea or a mold that you think that other person is supposed to fit in, you'll never be satisfied with them. Because people live in reality, not in the fantasy. Well, another thing that Betty told me, and this has probably been one of the greatest tools for changing my life in every area, and that has been, have you ever thought about asking God to let you see your mother as he sees her? Never once gave a thought about how God looked at anybody. And I said, no. And she said, well, why don't you try that? Well, I was afraid to. And finally one afternoon, I was on my mother, going over to my mother's in the fall of the year, and I said, God, if it be your will, I'd like to see my mother like you see her. And when I drove up in the yard, Mama was raking leaves, and she looked real small. Funny, my mom always looked real formidable and mean to me, and here was this little old small, I mean, heck, she wasn't but about 5'2 or 3, you know, just a little big old dinky thing. And, I mean, she could walk under my arm darn near, you know, and I thought, my God, I never noticed that before. And it was like you could see through her. And I could see her heart, and it had scars on her heart. And she looked like a person who was very fearful, like a person who needed love, not a person who had love to give. And I realized I was the one who had been taught how to love here in the program. My mother didn't have anyone to teach her to love. And so I went over and I asked my mother to put her leaf broom down. And I put my arms around her. Well, you see, we don't touch. And my mother, boy, she stiffened up. But I needed to do that for me. Well, that made another change on the inside of me. It didn't make anything with Mother and I any different, but it made a change on the inside of me because, you see, I had compassion for my mother. That was the first time I had ever felt any type of good, positive feeling toward her. And so more time went by, and then I realized my relationship with my daddy wasn't wonderful, and he wasn't perfect. After all, he was a human being. And I had made him a saint in my mind, and then I had compared her to him. She would always come up short. And I realized how unfair that was to do that to another person. And so one day I went over to my mother's, and we were talking. And she said, you know, I never could understand why when your daddy died, you were such an ornery kid. And I said, well, Mama, I was getting even with you for not loving me. And she said, not loving you? And I said, no. I said, Mama, you never ever told me I did good. You never hugged me. You never kissed me. You never did anything to let me know that you loved me. And my mother looked up at me and she said, I gave you a roof over your head. I gave you clothes to wear. I gave you food to eat. It was more than I had. Well, my mother came from that alcoholic family, and she had had to run away when she was 13 years old because her father tried to rape her. And she lived on the streets back in the early 1900s. It wasn't fashionable to be a street person then. She had eaten out of garbage cans and stolen food out of people's gardens to survive until she met my daddy at the age of 16 and got married. My mother had never been taught how to love. To her, the most loving thing you could do for a child would be to give them a roof over their head, food to eat and clothes to wear, because see, it's things that she never had. And you see, I took those, just like she did my straight A's, I took those things for granted. That was what you were supposed to do. See, I was doing the very same thing she was doing. And she looked at me and she said, you know, I just don't understand. And I said, well, Mama, I understand more right now than I've ever understood in my life. And, you know, I'd try to make an amends to my mother for many times, and it'd always screw up somehow. We'd get into a fuss every time I started making amends. But that afternoon, I looked at her, and you know why I know we made a mess every time we tried to make an amends? Because I was doing it because I'd been told to do it, not because I felt it. I felt like she had done me more wrong than I had her. And I knew that day it wasn't true, because that woman had always given the best she had, and I refused it, rubbed it in her face, and treated her terrible. And I knew it that day. And I said, Mama, how in the world, what could I ever do to make it up to you for all the harm that I've caused you and all the hurt all these years? And my mother said, forgive me for not being the kind of mother you needed. And my mother put her arms around me, and she held me, and she said, baby, I love you. I've always loved you. And she had, to the best of her ability. And that was the healing of our relationship. And we went along for a long time and had a very good relationship. That doesn't mean we didn't argue occasionally, but I never had that feeling of hate and that all those negative things come back up. I didn't have those long, deep-seated feelings anymore. God healed those that afternoon at my mother's. And I'm glad that I had those years with my mother, because about 4.5, 5 years ago, my mother began to get sick again. My mother began to develop a mental illness. And it started like alcoholism. It didn't make any sense, and it was progressive. That's about the only way I can describe it. All of a sudden, my mother began to accuse me of stealing. She began to tell me that I would take things, and then when she'd find them, where she'd put them, she'd say, "You brought it back." And I laughed about it for a while, and then after a while it got pretty serious because she kept getting more things, and then she began to feel like her life was being threatened, and it really, really bothered me. And my sister is older than I am, and so she had mother's power of attorney, and I would tell Dorothy, I said, "Dorothy, we need to do something with mother," and Dorothy doesn't have a program. She was in great denial, and she said, "No, no, not yet, not yet." I said, "Okay." Well, it all culminated right before Easter last year. My mother called me over to her house and said, "I want to talk to you." And I went over there, and my mother physically attacked me. And she backed me up against the door, and she started hitting on me and telling me that she had a warrant sworn out for me, and she was going to have me put in jail. And it was a really, really bad, bad thing. And I knew then that I could not go around my mother anymore. And what was there was not my mother, but yet it's still in my mother's body, and it was very, very confusing for me, and it was very, very painful, and I thought, "Wait a minute, I've been through all this crap before and all this stuff. Why is this happening again?" See, that just shows you that you have to go sometimes to deeper and deeper layers of growth and acceptance. That's all it amounts to. And so I told my sister, I said, "I'm sorry, but I won't be able to do things with mother. I won't be able to take care of her like I have been. I just can't do it anymore." And so my sister agreed. And in June, my mother had a massive stroke. Something had to be done now. And my mother lost the ability to communicate. She couldn't read nor write after the stroke, nor could she talk. And all she could do would be express herself by saying, "Wee woe, wee woe, wee woe." And she would try, she was very animated, and she'd say, "Wee woe, wee woe, wee woe, wee woe." Now that would drive you crazy. And but before her ability to read and write totally left her, she was in the rehab unit. And she tried to write something one night. And I was looking at this because, see, I hadn't spoken to my mother all that period of time. And she wrote, and finally I'd go word by word trying to decipher what she had written on this page. And what my mother asked on this page was, "Will you forgive me?" And I put my arms around my mother and I said, "Yes, Mom, I forgive you and I love you. And I'm real grateful that I did that." Well, as time went on, in October, my mother had another massive stroke. And at this point in time, my mother was paralyzed and she just sort of lay there. And all she could do at this point was just cry occasionally. Last Friday, I was at a conference in my home group. We decided last summer to have a conference, just our home group, because we have a very large group of over 100 people in my home group. And we were at the conference, and I got the call last Friday night. My mother had passed away. And I thought, how wonderful of God to put me with the people that love me and understand me and would carry me all weekend. Where could you be in a better place than with a group of that many people who love you at a time like that? And when we made the arrangements, my mother had gotten very wretched looking from October on. She didn't even look like a human being much anymore. God created the miracle. The woman who used to do her hair many years ago said, "I want to do your mama's hair." That's such an important thing for the family, for that woman to look like she's supposed to look. And she, I want you to know, my mother looked 25 years younger. She was absolutely beautiful. It was raining Tuesday when we buried her. Right before the service, God stopped the rain. We had the service. 10 minutes later, it started raining again. My God does such wonderful things. And do you know something? My mother was 89 years old. She had 3 friends that were left. There was 50 people there for me, for my group. And there were the people from my sister's office that were there. And they couldn't under... All the people kept saying, those are the huggingest group of people I ever saw. We have a tradition, Helen knows, in our group, we're rubbing people. We like to rub on each other's backs, and it's just sort of comforting. All during the service, one of the girls that I sponsor had her hand on my back and was loving me. All during it, they've walked me every step of the way. That's why it was important for me to come to you today and to let you know that there is recovery. You see, my mama's not hurting anymore. And during that time that my mother was in the nursing home, I was able to hug her. I was able to kiss her. And she responded. She would respond to that. I was able to do more and feel better about her. And you see, God gave me that time so that I could let go of her. And last year at Mother's Day, I know I'm going over too long, but I'm going to tell you anyway, if you need to leave, leave. It won't be but about another 5 minutes here, and then we can all, you know, quit slinging snot and go. Helen called me on Saturday before Mother's Day. And it was a real hard Mother's Day because, you see, at that point I had not spoken to my mother, and it didn't seem right on Mother's Day not to give your mother a card, go see her or something. But the doctor had agreed that I should stay away from my mother. And so Helen called me and she said, Mary Pearl, I want to thank you for being my mother. And God used Helen because she started telling me some things that I had done for her that had been nurturing. And when I hung up the phone, I said, God, where's my mama? I said, I never had all that all my life. I said, where was my mama? Now you say that we're supposed to have what we need right there when we need it. Now where was it? And all of a sudden it was like I had a real quick flashback and my whole life just passed. And I realized when I was a little bitty girl, I felt real special because my sister had got me a subscription to Donald Duck comic books. And I was the only kid that got mail. That was real important when you're a little kid to get a piece of mail, and I got one every month. And then I got to thinking, when I became a little lady, who told me all about the facts of life? My sister. And when I wanted a store-bought dress, my mama was a dressmaker, so you didn't get store-bought clothes. When I had an absolute craving, I wanted my senior prom formal to be a store-bought dress. My sister took me down to the fanciest dress shop in Little Rock, and she got me and ordered me a Michael Bonet original from New York and had it sent in. And I tell you, I felt like $1 million. And when I got married, who was right there with me, encouraging me? My sister. And when I was in Newfoundland and couldn't have so many things that were back here, who sent them? Who sent airmail packages in 1960 with $30 worth of postage on it? My sister. She sent me dried onions and tangerines. You couldn't get them over there. And you can't cook without onions. You're from the South. You know how that is. And you couldn't get the fresh fruit up there. So therefore, I mean, she did things. It was against the law to send food. She sent it anyway. And when I was going crazy, when I was going through all my doing my thing, finding myself, my sister, people would say, what's happened to Mary Pearl? And Dorothy would say, I don't know, but she's my sister and I love her anyway. And she never gave up on me. And as I began to see that, I realized my sister had been my mama all my life. My sister's 15 years older than I am, and she had been my mama to me all my life. She had been right there doing. And because she was my sister and I didn't have anything to compare it to, I thought all sisters did that. And then I thought, I never heard anybody's sister did stuff like that. It's just like you just, all of a sudden it was like God took the scales off my eyes and I saw. And so when I left the meeting, I went by the drugstore just a few minutes before closing. And you know how picked over cards are, right, at the last minute. If I had been, there had been 3 million cards, the card I wanted was sitting right there. And I left there with that card, and I ran down to the florist shop. And if there'd have been 100 potted plants or anything there, my sister loves azaleas. And there was the biggest pot of double red bloomed azaleas I'd ever seen. And I said, that's it. And I got it, and I just wrote on the bottom of that card, thank you, Dorothy, for being my mama all my life. I couldn't have had a better one. And I took that over to my sister. And I walked in with those flyers and I set them down and Dorothy said, what's the occasion? I said, shut up and read the card. And she read it and she started crying. And she put her arms around me and she said, you've always been my baby to me. So she couldn't have children either. So I was her child to her. And J.D. was watching all this and he started squalling and he said, can I have some of that too? So we all three held our arms around each other, and we mended, and we bonded together as a family. And little did we know how important that was going to be, because less than a month later, that's all there would be of us, because Mother was not able to participate anymore. So you see, God does the miracles. You just do the legwork, you just suit up and show up, and God will do it for you when you become willing. When you become willing. I can't impress upon you the importance of the willingness to do what you're asked to do, and the miracle will take place. My life is but a weaving between my God and me. I do not choose the colors, but He worketh steadily. Oft times in sorrow, sometimes foolish pride, I forget He sees the top while I the underside. Not till the loom is silent and the shuttle cease to fly will God unroll the canvas and explain the reasons why. But the dark threads are as needful in a skillful weaver's hand as the threads of gold and silver in the pattern God has planned. Thank you.